good morning. You are in the panel discussion, How Do We Produce Great Writers? And why don't we open in prayer? Father, we thank you for this morning. We thank you for what we heard. We pray now that we would be helped by this panel discussion on how to produce great writers. We pray that it would be practical, informative, and would bring you much glory in how it would help us. We just pray that you would give the panelists clear thinking. We pray that you would just make this time an encouragement to each person that is here today and honoring to you. And we ask this in your name. Amen. What we're going to do is I will introduce the panelists one at a time, and they will then give a brief talk on writing. Notice on your tables that there are index cards kind of spread out on the tables. As the panelists give their talk, you may write questions for them. And I will then collect the questions and hand them to the panelists after they give their brief talk, and they will answer your questions. The third panelist, Annie Petzinger, has a handout for you. That's what you see on your table. So that's for her. So I'm going to begin now and introduce you to Jim Selby. He is the founder of Classical Composition and has authored a classical writing curriculum that has been used both in the classroom and in the homeschooling community. And so he will begin with his first discussion on writing.
Well, it's truly an honor to be here this morning, and I appreciate your time. As you can see in the manual or the book, I've got a lot to say in 10 minutes here, but I'll keep a high 10,000-foot view, and hopefully we can begin a good discussion with Todd and Annie. I think all of us as classical Christian educators understand that ideas are important. That's why we do what we do, is because we believe that philosophy, worldview, the way that we approach who man is, all of these inform who we have become as classical Christian schools. The idea of classical language theory is a very different idea from modern composition theory or process theory. And those ideas of all those three theories of language come out of a culture. And it's critical if we want to produce great writers of the past that we think seriously about the language theory of the past and the pedagogies of the past that produced those great writers. When we're looking at classical discourse theory, the first division that we see is around purpose. So when we communicate in classical discourse theory, our first question is, what are we doing? Are we persuading about the past, the present, or the future? That division, that first division, informs the pedagogy from rhetoric all the way down through the progymnosmata. Because if we are training students to be successful at persuading people around those three areas, there are a very unique and effective set of skills that we can utilize and change depending upon what our purpose is. Okay. Gifted speakers can achieve those purposes without technique, without knowledge, simply by being gifted. However, in the past, what we've seen is the very most gifted of artists enhance and increase their giftedness. They don't enslave themselves to their natural ability, but in fact, they're able by training to go beyond what they're capable of naturally and achieve greatness. That same pedagogy can take non-gifted individuals and train them to become competent writers. In order to achieve that purpose, rhetoric has developed five canons. As writing teachers, we're most concerned with invention, arrangement, and style. If we get students into our rhetoric classes that have never had experience or training or laying a foundation for those three concepts of inventing arguments, arranging them according to purpose, and creating styles that will elicit pathos in our audiences, to do that in 2 or 3 years is an overwhelming task. And in fact, in some ways, I think it's impossible. The progymnasmata was the classical pedagogy to prepare students to master the five canons, which are necessary to achieve purpose in persuading about the past, the present, or the future. The vertical integration of classical pedagogy is brilliant, and it's tight, it's refined, and it's extremely effective in producing students who can write and speak well. If we're looking to achieve great writers in our culture today, we have a pedagogy, we have a language theory, we have curriculum that will allow us to do that. As classical Christian educators, this should come naturally to us. We're already looking to the past in the liberal arts. We're already looking to the past when we conceive of our education around grammar, logic, and rhetoric. We have curriculum from the past, explicit curriculum, that will teach our students how to become great writers. It's there. Ideas matter. To create curriculums or to use curriculums based upon a language theory that views man from an unbiblical perspective is already beginning to cause us difficulties. When we look around at our culture today and we see what's happening with using curriculums that are based on either modern composition theory or process theory, the fruits of those curriculums are disappointing, to say the least. The fact that we're all in this room attests to that matter. Those classical discourse theory curriculums are available to us. We just need to go out and use them. And we know through experience for 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, 15 years that classical pedagogies do produce excellent writers. I think it behooves us as a community to access those pedagogies and then begin our conversation together in terms of how these pedagogies are being effectively used in our classrooms. Because it'll differ. As it has in the past, we have a basic framework for writing curriculum, but in each of our communities, in each of our schools, with each of our teachers, that's going to look a little different. If we're going to access this rich pedagogy, we all need to be accessing it and talking to one another about what's working and what's not working. There's simply no reason as classical Christian schools that we shouldn't be deeply involved in deep study and deep application to the curriculum, to the teaching methods of the past, in figuring out how to best incorporate those and put those into contemporary classrooms. I'm looking around this room here, and we have such amazingly gifted people. And as George Grant told us, the task we have before us is changing our world, changing our culture. Equipping students with language, making them masters of the ability to communicate, is key to that cultural change that we're all here for. So it's an important subject, it's a big idea, and we all need to be working together looking at texts that we know are effective in teaching kids to communicate. Thank you. The question is resources for existing classical curriculum patterns, a book list, examples of texts to consider. Quintilian is probably the consummate teacher of rhetoric teachers. His Institutio de Oratoria is complete. So if you if you're looking for probably the most effective articulation of how do we teach rhetoric, then Quintilian would be my recommendation. Before we teach rhetoric, historically, again for millennia, the Progymnasmata was used. We have four extant copies of the Progymnasmata available to us today, and we have a growing list of curriculums that have been created out of the Progymnasmata. There are at least two college textbooks that have incorporated the Progymnasmata and is using those. There's an online resource, Classical Writing, that's developed around the Progymnasmata. I know Annie has given workshops at the ACCS on the Progymnasmata. So there's lots of resources out there as we try to figure out how we can best use these before exercises for rhetoric in our particular situation in our classroom, and there's no monolithic way to do it. Okay, we can there are models that we can use and begin to pattern, but as we find our particular students in our particular communities, the wonderful thing about the Progymnasmata is its flexibility. Okay, but if you're going to prepare students for rhetoric to teach them the five canons, okay, again I'm passionate and maybe a little too radical about this, but why would you do anything other than what we always did, the Progymnasmata? And again, it's not monolithic. It allows you as a writing teacher to be immensely creative in developing extraordinarily enjoyable contexts for your students to master this skill. So a list of books. If you go to D'Angelo's book or Sharon Haughey's book, not Sharon Haughey, Deborah Haughey and Sharon Crowley, thank you. Wonderful bibliographies in the back. On my website, Classical Composition, I have a short bibliography, but could keep you busy for a summer anyway. There's just tons of material out here. Do a Google search. And I think there's like 20,000 entries now around the ProGym. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of stuff out there. Those two college texts and Quintilian are a great place to start.
Did you see these other questions? Is there another question?
Yeah, how will we have time left?
Okay. So just one question each or something?
Let's do that. Yeah. And then if we have time for more,
okay.
We can do that.
Okay, Todd Wadle is next. He is from Veritas Classical Academy in Oklahoma, and he is author of Veritas's Progymnasmata-based writing curriculum.
Thank you. Like Jim, I'm honored to be here speaking to you, and hope that what I have to say is helpful to you as you seek to train up good writers. As I was preparing my remarks, my brother sent me this aphorism from Winston Churchill. He says, "Writing is an adventure. To begin with, it is a toy and an amusement. Then it becomes a mistress. Then it becomes a master. Then it becomes a tyrant. The last phase is that just as you are about to be reconciled to your servitude, you kill the monster and fling him to the public." And as I got this, I thought, well, one, that's humorous, as much of Churchill is, but two, it's also insightful. And two things I'd like to draw from Churchill as I begin. The first is that the progression from toy to tyrant is not because of repetition. Churchill isn't saying this is because you're writing a lot of different things. His focus is on this progression happens as you're writing one thing. You start out toying around with it, it progresses and finally you kill it and fling it to the public. Which, if you've ever finished something, that's kind of how it feels. I'm just done with this. Thank you very much. The other thing is that what's interesting is you would think you get to the end, it's a monster you kill, you fling it to the public. Okay, that sounds really bad. But he starts out saying, it's an adventure. It doesn't stop being an adventure when you kill it and fling it to the public. That is a part of the adventure. If there is no progression from toy to killing the monster, it's not an adventure. Right? You have to have darkness to have an adventure. And so as I looked at this, I thought, well, this is actually, serendipitously enough, what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about revision because this is what I think Churchill is talking about. He's talking about one work, the craft you have to put into it, and the progression that you go through. And in the spirit of revision, I've done a little bit of revision on the outline that I gave you. Sorry. On your outline, the questions for point one, A through D, are all separated out. Really, you can't separate them. The question of how do I think about writing, how do I think about my students, how do my students think about writing, how do they think about themselves, are absolutely inseparable. The way that you think about writing will be the way that you think about your students. The way that your students think about their own writing will be the way that they think about themselves. This is inescapable. And so as we approach this, we need to be aware of this. This is one of the things that we have to be aware of. We have to think about how are we thinking about writing, and then what does this say about our anthropology of our students? And similarly, the way that we structure our writing curriculum will be the way that they will think about themselves. And so there are two dangers here. One is to see writing ultimately as a formula. Setting up a pattern and saying, well, okay, here's the model. And we think if we get the model right, somehow they're going to become good writers. That's simply not true. And what this will produce in us is the desire to do a pedagogy that's something like this. Here's an assignment, you return it. Here's another assignment, essentially the same one, return it. And if I keep doing this enough, you're going to catch on to what I'm doing, and you're going to suddenly have this magical moment and become a good writer. Well, no, what that's going to breed is anger, frustration, and angst. It simply doesn't work. And that says what we're thinking about our students is that if I place you in a mold, I will get a certain outcome. We're actually being very, very good behaviorists. At the other extreme, we can approach writing as most of our students tend to think about writing, which is it's this mysterious, amorphous thing, and there are good writers and there are bad writers, and who knows the difference, and you can't tell and you can't change. Now, we may fall into exactly the same problem of, well, since I can't change anyone, I'm just going to keep this process, and the good writers will eventually develop, independent of what I did. And the mediocre writers might show a slight improvement, but really, you know what, you can't really do a whole lot. And what you'll see is, and again, those are drastic extremes. Very few people do either extreme, but those are the extremes. Students will then approach their own writing as this sort of, well, if I'm a good writer, guess what, I'm good. And you can't really do anything to help me. Or I'm not a writer, and so, well, okay, I'll kind of struggle through this. And increasingly I'll be mad at you because you're grading me on things that I can't possibly have done well. And so we need to think about, are we instead, if we really believe and if we really see our students as creatures involved in a narrative, this is what they are, this is inescapable, then we need to be willing to approach our writing curriculum that way. We need to structure a writing curriculum that treats them as creatures in a process, and that's what revision means. Now, if this is what we want, we need to realize that the more that we engage with students in their writing, the more entangled, and by that I mean the messier it will become. If we really engage, the messier it will become, and as they engage, the messier it will become. We need to not flee that, we need to not avoid that. That is inescapable about teaching writing. So if we want that, then we need to, again, be careful to say, okay, if this is what we want, how do we help them learn the process and learn to love the process? Because that's really what good writing is. I'll often tell my students, good writing is good revision. Good writing is good rewriting. That's all it is. Nobody produces a first draft that's perfect. The exception to that I've heard is that apparently C.S. Lewis would write out things longhand, his secretary would come in, and they'd be perfect. Okay, and I'll often tell them, I don't think any of you is C.S. Lewis. If you are, I'm wrong, and things will be happy. What that means is we have to say, okay, well, where are they at an age or level specific, where are they in that framework? Structure assignments for that and structure assignments with increasing difficulty and increasing depth. We want them going further up and further in. But we want them working on the same concept in that progression. And so as a basic element, one of the things I'll do is say, well, here's the, and we use the Progenitus Modus, so I'll say, here, you're doing a CREA. Okay, well, first, we're all doing, as a class, a CREA on the same topic. Okay. Next, we're doing a CREA, and I've divided it up into groups, and so you have different ones you're working on. And then finally, you get to go pick whatever you want, within reason. You always have to add that caveat. And so what this does is, this, again, it doesn't just mean you're doing the same thing. Okay, well, when you move from that class to the group, you're going to do different things and increasingly more complex things and increasingly moving to the individual. So there's a progression, there's a cycling through. But you have to build that in. Right? That has to be a structure of the assignment. The other thing that you have to do then is you have to build in revision to the process. You cannot simply tell them to revise. They won't do it. They simply won't. Why? It's work, it's hard, and right, it feels like it's a tyrant. Okay, great. So you actually have to say, well, no, you have to go through a drafting process. You absolutely must do it. It means you have to devote time in class to be willing to have them do that. Because if you let them go home, even if it's required, they're not going to do it. So I'll give them time in class and say, okay, you have 15 minutes. You have to be working on your draft for the next 15 minutes. And it's one they've turned in. It's one I've turned back with comments. You must revise during this time. It's a requirement. You have to make them do it. Otherwise, they won't. And you need to be there to help them think through those things, right? I've written a comment, and I think it's perfectly clear. And one of my students says, I have no idea what you mean by this. Okay, great. Well, let's enter into dialogue. You and me dialoguing, and you dialoguing with your own writing. You have to be willing to do this. If we have to do that in the way we structure assignments, we also have to do that in the way that we evaluate assignments. You need to evaluate them not just based upon a finished product, but upon the way that they've gone through the process. Okay? I don't mean that a student who has done a lot of revision should instantly somehow score better than a student who is a good writer or has produced something good. Right? What I do mean is, let's say that you have a student who's turned in a first draft, and their first draft is an A first draft. And I make that distinction because an A first draft is not the same thing as an A final draft. The temptation for them is to say, well, great, I've got my A, thanks. You can't let them do that. They will stagnate, right? If their first draft and you say, wow, this is for a fifth grader, this is really good. It's an A paper. That's a first draft. You have to include, but I'm going to make you revise. And if you turn in a final draft, which looks the same thing as your rough draft, I actually will grade you down. Not because somehow your writing has changed between the two, but because I'm asking you to do things, right? This is a part of the learning process, and your paper was not somehow perfect and beautiful. Because the reality is, nothing's ever perfect and beautiful in that sense. It's effective and it's ineffective, and it's relative to objective standards, and you can always be improving. You have to be willing to build this in. Again, if you don't, it's simply not going to happen. And so as we approach this, these are the sorts of things that are necessities to produce good writers. The process really matters. Now, what this means, then, in the final analysis is this question, how do we produce good writers? Which I'm going to say is a little bit of an enigma and a mystery. If I don't believe that getting the model right is true, that's going to somehow produce good writers. Nor can I entirely believe that if I get the process right, I'm going to produce good writers. I have to ask three questions. What do I think I as a teacher can do? What do I think my students can do? And then what do I think God is doing? When you think about yourself as a teacher and you look at your students, a couple of questions for yourself are you willing to take the long view of their development as a writer? It is a skill, it is an art, both. Are you willing to take the long view and say, okay, where they are at the first, they may struggle a long time with some certain things in writing. Are you okay with that? Are you willing to work with them in that? Are you willing to enter into the chaos of their language and help them find order? Are you willing to have arguments with parents, constructive, useful, grace-filled arguments with parents about those things? Because parents are going to fight you too. Well, what do you mean that little Johnny got an A minus instead of an A because he didn't revise, but it's an A paper. Okay, have that fight. My student simply isn't a writer. That's not true. You have to be willing to take the long view. And sometimes this means we need to not get caught into a 1 year, I've got this student for 1 year, I've got to somehow get everything addressed. That's a faulty system. Right? You have to say, I may see this much improvement, but I'm taking the long view. Right? They're going to struggle for years. That's fine. That's good. Be working with other teachers and saying, hey, this is where they've struggled. They're probably still going to struggle here, but look for the successes. Right? Look for the successes with them. So be willing to take the long view, be willing to enter into that chaos, and be willing to have the hard conversations. For your students, as you look at your students, again, remember that the way that you think about them as writers is the way that they will think about themselves. And so what do you expect of them? Do you expect them to actually develop as writers? You need to. The student who is struggling does not mean they're not developing as a writer. What it means is they're struggling. And struggling is learning. Most of the best writers, in my experience as I've taught writing, are the ones who have struggled. Even the ones who naturally have a great facility and gift, they struggle, and that's when they get better. As Jim said, you know, it's not gifted, and that's it. It's augmenting your giftedness. And when I talk in the point above about natural and unnatural, all I wanted to say about that is students think that they naturally know how to write because they naturally use language. Right? So when you tell them, okay, you're going to use a metaphor. They say, well, okay, but I already know how to do that. Look, I just used one. I'll say, yeah, but you didn't know that you used it. Right? I want them to be informed natural writers. I should, and I'll tell them this, I should be, if you are really a great writer, be able to look at anything in your paper and ask you, why is that there? Now, you didn't know that ahead of time as you were writing, but I should be able to say, why did you put that word there? And we should be able to have an intelligent conversation about it. Right? That's what I want to expect from my students. Do I believe that that's what they can get to? Do I believe that they can actually bring order out of chaos? And do I then champion that for them? Because if I don't, they won't either. And they will see themselves as creatures who cannot change. And it actually speaks to how they think about sanctification. And then what do we think God is doing? It's really important to remember that we can't make anyone learn anything. We simply can't. We can place them, we can pick models, which are good models, and I highly recommend everything Jim said about the program notes motto leading to rhetoric, yes. We can pick good processes like revision, yes. We can place them in those, yes. We can help them, we can dialogue. Ultimately, people learn because God gives them learning. Right? And so we need to ask students to engage, and we need to be willing to pray for this, and we need to teach them to engage and ask that God would meet them in that engagement, in the messiness of their writing. That's what they need, is that's where they really encounter God. They need that in their learning. And we need to believe that he will act there. Now, this could all sound like drudgery. Oh my gosh, you tell me that I'm in for a fight. Yep, you are. That doesn't mean it's not an adventure. That actually means it is an adventure. And we need students who get excited about, well, you know, but what if I move this here? And you say, well, yeah, but if you do that, you also lose this. And not have their face fall, but instead say, oh, well, is that a trade-off I want? Well, I don't know. Try it. I can't tell you what it's going to look like. And we want that to be what they're after. Because that is when really we'll have good writers, is when they're willing to do that and to take risks, confident in what we expect of them, what they know of themselves, and what God is doing.
Speaking of revisions, we're going to revise just a little bit here. If you have questions for Todd, write his name on the top of the card, and I'm going to go ahead and let Annie do her presentation now. And if you have questions for Annie, you can put them on the top of her card, and then I will just hand them. I will collect them at the end of her presentation, and then we'll do questions at the end. How about that? Annie Petzinger is from Westminster Academy, which happens to be my school. She was charged with studying and training our teachers in our writing curriculum, which is the Institute for Excellence in Writing. She was also charged with researching writing curriculums, which included the ProGymnasmata, and she is our resident expert.
This works. thank you. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Yay. All right, it works. All right, good morning. I am speaking. Whenever you put a foreign, or especially a Latin or a Greek word in your title, it's always a little bit difficult to get started because one has to assume that copia isn't a term that is used too often, although we do get the word copious from it, and so already we should have an idea that we are talking about being able to do a lot of something. And one hopes as well that our students are able to do a lot of writing, but that's not what really copia is about. Copia, at its Latin root, means supply, and in the plural it means troops, and the warlike metaphor is apropos. A student trains and drills, preparing for that inevitable and imminent day of battle, when he steps out from the shade of his teacher's guardian wing and stands up for himself, his cause, his beliefs, or his God. After David set aside the soldier's gear and took up his sling and his stones, he stood before Goliath and spoke with strong words, courageous, confident, and coherent. You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. How sad for our modern Davids, who cower before their Goliath peers and professors and mumble, well, it's not like, you know, that I want to disagree, but I just don't think what you're saying is right. How do we train up warriors? Each teacher from kindergarten through professor has a role in this, training the soul on story and myth, nourishing the soul with the truths of God, preparing the warrior to stand confidently and to speak clearly. But for these short minutes, let us focus on the soldier in training, especially as he enters phase two, middle school. The student entering middle school, roughly grades 5 through 8, has completed phase one, the basics, basic training, studying, reading, learning how to write, learning the basics of grammar. In phase three, high school, he'll dive deep into content, analyzing, synthesizing, re-expressing in lengthy written and oral presentations. I liked middle school, not high school. In phase two, copia should be our focus. Copia equips a student with the tools of expression. It readies him to speak, knowing that his arsenal is replete with vocabulary, metaphor, and other literary devices. Phase two practices the student in how to say a thing. It's phase three that drills the student in what to say. A student competent in copia is an artist of language, who has ready at hand an extensive array of words and figures from which he can immediately select what is most suitable, able in the fewest possible words so to comprehend the essence of a matter that nothing is lacking, able to amplify by copia in such a way that there is, nonetheless, no redundancy. In truth, this training will assure that we will not frequently hesitate in bewilderment or keep shamefully silent. I'm quoting from Erasmus's essay on copia of words and ideas, which is quite short and approachable, and I highly recommend it for any teacher who is looking to expand his own interest and his own skill in writing. Erasmus was a medieval in that he liked to list things, and so it can be repetitious, but on the other hand, it also gives us a great supply of ideas and examples, a copia of examples, if you will. Erasmus draws extensively from classical and Christian rhetoricians and authors like Virgil, Quintilian, St. Jerome, Cicero, and Homer, and he lays out for students the elements of copia. I am not able to go through Erasmus here. I want to, but I decided I needed to keep this short, but I do encourage you to read it. The first section is basically copia of words, how to say things, and the second section is copia of ideas, which is a rundown of the progymnasmata, and so it gives students the ways of thinking about a subject and amplifying what they want to say, so highly suggest. Where then can we see copia? Everywhere, Copia abounds in an author of any skill. Copia is what takes a story from its bare bones to something worth reading. Let us then teach our students to appreciate language by being ourselves appreciators of this language. I always give my students a taste of Kenneth Graham, C.S. Lewis, and G.K. Chesterton because they are masters and because they are my favorite. I am always sure to state exactly what I think is compelling about their language, as we need to give our students a vocabulary of critique. So, for example, we read together this excerpt from The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham. He thought his happiness was complete when, as he meandered aimlessly along, suddenly he stood by the edge of a full-fed river. Never in his life had he seen a river before. This sleek, sinuous, full-bodied animal, chasing and chuckling, gripping things with a gurgle and leaving them with a laugh to fling itself on fresh playmates that shook themselves free and were caught and held again. All was a shake and a shiver, glints and gleams and sparkles, rustle and swirl, chatter and bubble. The mole was bewitched, entranced, fascinated. Triple extension. Janet, I saw you in the audience. I like you. This paragraph could be paraphrased like this. Mole walked alongside the river. It gets the point across, clear and concise, but the meagerness of it robs the reader of the joy of reading. We use paragraphs like this to train students to see beauty in language. First, we will note the vocabulary: meandered, aimlessly, sinuous, fleeing, bewitched. Graham never seems to use the same word twice. Erasmus notes that although we grant there to be no difference at all in meaning, yet some words are more becoming than others, more exalted, more polished, more humorous, more emphatic, more sonorous, more suited to composition. For there is no word that is not the best in some place, except for the word very. Words are where we first look to find copia. Next, we explore Graham's use of personification of the river as an animal. We note this amazing triple alliteration of chasing and chuckling, gripping with a gurgle, leaving with a laugh. We'll note onomatopoeia with a shake and a shiver and all these adjectives, verbs, nouns, whatever they are. And then we'll also note, this triple participle at the end that slows us down and helps us with mole to stand amazed at this river. The mole was bewitched, entranced, fascinated. And note, he drops the "and," which should be there when you have things in a series, but there's a rhetorical device when you drop the "and," and then you have, you're allowed to do it. Enthymeme. Is that right? Nope, it's not. Okay. Ellipsis. I don't know. Thank you. Asyndeton. I teach middle school, not rhetoric. I'm so sorry. We feed and nourish the imaginations of students with vocabulary and structures. We encourage them to mimic these masters until they have mastered the medium. The day after looking at that excerpt, for example, I'll have students retell a fable using the descriptive devices of Graham. And I've had students attempt a triple alliteration, like flinging or leaving it with a laugh, chasing and chuckling, and I have gotten some genius writing from them. Not all of them do it well. Some of them do, others improve, because we are revising and revising and revising. Erasmus notes that all things ought to be exaggerated for training. He says, "I'm instructing youth in whom extravagance of speech does not seem wrong, because with judgment, superfluities are easily restrained. Certain of them, even, age itself wears away, while on the other hand, you cannot by any method cure meagerness and poverty. Indeed, restraining or curbing a student's appetite for strings of adjectives or adverbs is much easier than trying to drag a modicum of description from an unwilling 12-year-old. I don't have time to share with you the 18 examples that I had chosen for this, but I would suggest you start in the Psalms, which are overflowing with copious vocabulary and images. Have students write their own Psalms, for example, based on something like Psalm 148, which is on that handout out there. Psalm 148 is itself in some ways a copia exercise on the one sentence, "Let them praise the Lord." On your handout also is the web address to a YouTube video of a comedian who takes the story, The Three Little Pigs, and retells it in the voice of Shakespeare, which is wonderful. But he smokes, so it's not super appropriate for younger children. That's to your discretion. I love it. Not smoking. I'm so sorry. It's very long, though, and I can't show it here, but there is pleasure in its hilarity. And I think that there's also no better way to practice copia than to take something familiar and rewrite it using an overabundance of language and figures. But more than just showing students examples of good writing and examples of copia, they should be working on their copia skills as well. I have my students trained that when we come in on Monday morning, they will see a copia drill on the board. I'll have a sentence or a piece of poetry or even just a random sentence. Once we did, "Thank you very much for your kind gift." And they're instructed to then write as many different versions of that sentence as they are able to. And we started out doing this together, and we worked on different skills. So the first week, we only looked at using synonyms to change the sentence. Then the next week, we used switching the voice or tense or mood of the verb in order to get a new type of sentence. Students were given a lot of liberty in this exercise, since I was concerned that they'd just be able to write something new. But after they got the hang of it, they started giving me beautiful examples. Before we went and saw The Diary of Anne Frank last year, I gave them this quote of hers: "I don't think of all the misery, but of the beauty that still remains." On the back of your handout, I have my versions of how you can manipulate the sentence to get different versions of it, practicing different methods of copia. So I do a sentence with synonyms, or I change around the order of the sentence. I change who does the action. I change the mood, and I turn it to imperative. Don't think of all the misery, but think of the beauty that still remains. So you have my examples, and I tend to be kind of dry in how I give examples, so I apologize. But my students had wonderful versions on this, and then they were able to use their copia exercise as a part of their bigger crea exercise from this, and they used it for a paraphrasing of her statement. So I had students who said, "Looking at all the pain and sorrows wouldn't get her anywhere. Instead, she decided to look at the bright side of things and notice the wonderful gifts that she still had." Or, "She didn't think of all the dreariness that still remained, but of the happiness to come." Or again, "She didn't mope about, but looked on the bright side of things." Or, "Try to always concentrate on everything good and beautiful in life. Don't even begin to consider all of the horrible things happening around you." Or, "Rather than thinking, focusing, and dwelling on the horrible hardships of persecution, she remained an optimist." And then finally, let me give you, we read Churchill and give a speech of his, and this student was rather influenced by him. "Look out of your dreary little cloud of self-pity and despair and look to the broad, sunlit uplands." Yeah, and I was so pleased. They also like to use the phrase, "odious apparatus of Nazi rule." Are some of these awkward? Yes, they will be awkward. Some of them even border on the ridiculous, and I let them know, too, sometimes when they have approached too ridiculous. But we're equipping these students so that later they may determine which is the exact word or phrasing or mood or tone to use. We must send these kids out into a great battle. Let us offer our Davids every weapon possible so that they can select whichever one God would have them use to achieve his victory.
You guys sort them out.
We thought I'd answer questions or talk.
Yeah, y'all work it out. I trust you completely.
Is that, yeah, we've got some for all of us.
Yeah, so you all have the time, right? So can I just trust you to kind of end it up and maybe somebody
What time does it start?
It ends at 50. It
okay,
ends
we,
at 50.
We don't have a lot of time. Jim? Todd?
Oh, I don't want to answer this one. Grading student writing in the lower, or in the logic rhetoric stage. Thoughts?
Well, that
and
actually goes to
computer use.
Okay. There are two questions here which kind of overlap. One is, how do we develop clear assessments that reflect good writing at each level when there can be no mastery of writing? And then a related question of grading student writing, especially in the logic and rhetoric stage. So when I want to be careful not to say that there's not mastery. It's that mastery is never finished. True masters always develop. And so when you think about, this is where grading is tricky in the sense that you have to think about where are they, age and level appropriate. So there's an element at which you say, here are the basic things that you have to have. Right. So for example, even into high school, I'll say, okay, well, if we're doing a refutation, let's say, you have to have at least, and I know some people wouldn't like this, also you have to have at least 8 body paragraphs, and you have to use at least 5 different categories. Why? Because I want to train them that they actually can do this, right? It's developing copia. Now, what I'll do then is they revise, they'll say, okay, well, you can cut some of those out, because good writers always actually write more and then take some out rather than the reverse. It's easier to pare down than it is to suddenly come up with stuff spontaneously. Okay, so there are elements where I say these are the most basic requirements of what you have to have. Beyond that, when you think about grading, it's establishing a standard that for this age level, this is an A paper. Right? It doesn't just have these things, but, and again, you require certain things, certain structural elements, certain stylistic elements, yes. Grading then becomes really an issue of discernment of saying this is the standard for an A paper, a B paper, a C paper, a D paper, and a failing paper. I'm going to be consistent, but that's where you have to have teachers who can exercise that discernment. You have to have teachers, again, it's a consistent standard, and it's not that, as I'll have students say, well, it's just subjective. No, it's not subjective, right? It's objective, but it's not objective in the sense that I can list everything out for you. Just like God's word is literally true, but that doesn't mean that every single word means something corresponding directly to something exactly in the world. Right? So it's really two aspects. It's saying what are the things that I can say these are things you must have. And then as I create a standard, I want to make that consistent. I want them to know what it is. This means when you have students who write papers, have them read their papers to each other. When you have students who write something excellent, read it to the other students and say, this is what is really good. And this is why it's really important to have age or level appropriate examples. The example should be an example of what you would expect a student at that age level to be able to produce as an A paper or slightly above. You always want to reach them, but you don't want to give them an example that is going to cause them to say, I could never do that. Right? If you do that, you're going to create anger, frustration, angst, and all those other things that you're trying to avoid. That's why having age-appropriate examples that you can say, this is what you could actually attain. This is what a good writer who has worked hard and who has worked through the process could attain, and it would be an A. Use that to help establish your standard. Right? This is where, as Jim has said, there's flexibility, right? Part of it is where you are, and part of it's the teachers you have, part of it's the demographics of your students. Where are they coming from? Are you in a high socioeconomic group where maybe there's a lot of already exemplary schools around, right? All of those things matter. Right? But that's how we as teachers tend to approach grading is establish those things, be consistent, and be honest with your students. This is also the reason that you don't comment on everything when a student turns a paper in, right? If you've ever gotten a paper back and it's all red or green or whatever color, I had this in college. I had a really good teacher, and what I do is I get my paper and say, oh, well, that's really nice. Even if 90% of the stuff is positive, what do you do? It's information overload. Right?
pick what you want them to revise and be consistent with that. And that means for one student, I'm going to pick something that I don't necessarily comment on another student. That's fine. Right? You've got to treat them as individuals, holding them to the standard. So I'll let, if either of you have.
Go ahead, Annie.
I would add that students feel a lot that writing is something mystical and amorphous. And so to give them a rubric on the front end is so helpful to them. I would also, though, caution them that just doing the bare minimum of what is the requirement is not an A. And so I would always leave in your rubric room for style or content or something that has many, many points attached to it that give you the flexibility to say, I know what type of a writer you are, and I can tell that this was not your best work, so that we're not giving A's to students who merely follow a checklist. Because an A means perfect, and I think we should be careful about giving A's that mean, or A pluses that mean perfection, to students who are not and can't be. Now, I'm not saying no paper gets an A plus, but that should be an extraordinary paper, the best one that student has ever produced. I would also encourage that, especially in the upper school where grammar and spelling should are not even taught formally necessarily, that grammar and spelling be somewhere on that rubric so that students know they're still held accountable. I take off 5% for every fragment or run-on, and that's in sixth grade. I would increase it to 10% to let students know there is no room for a looseness of language just because you have a first draft.
I think this is where a classical pedagogy in terms of assessment is very helpful. Because as we use classical pedagogies, the whole process is understanding what the discrete skills are that make up a skill cluster that make up a communication. So if we're clear on what the discrete skills are that we want our students to learn, assessment becomes much easier. And this is one of the strengths of division that underlies and is the foundation of classical pedagogy. Now, the weakness of classical pedagogy is, as Todd pointed out, you can end up with something that isn't organic, that it's not real, right? Because it's artificial, and that's a danger that as classical educators we need to be sure doesn't happen. That's why we teach rhetoric. Because ultimately, in rhetoric, we're down to simply one rule: does it work? Okay, and so we need to be careful as we're dividing our discrete skills that we understand that anything they write, from a fable to a crea to a refutation, confirmation, or to a declamation, it's an organic whole. Classical education understands that. The underlying theory is that any whole has parts. And that's where we begin to cohere with a biblical understanding of creation, because we are organic wholes. We live in the present. We're immediate creatures, and yet within God's creation, everything has parts. There are generals, and there are particulars. That's how God created us in our creation, and so classical pedagogy fits with that. Anytime we use any kind of a theory, right, that's an abstraction, we are in danger of becoming artificial and unreal. And so we have to constantly be working there. That's one of the great strengths of process theory, is it highlights that, and it keeps us honest, and that's a good thing. We need to be organic and real in our communications.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, maybe just quickly, what components of the classical discourse theory are most critical to instruct? And again, we're pointing to rhetoric and the five canons, and as writing teachers, we're not concerned so much with memory and delivery, which is the oral component of a rhetorical situation, but we are wholly concerned significantly concerned, most importantly concerned, with the ability to invent, in other words, to create arguments, acknowledged by Cicero as the most difficult task of the writer, but we also have to arrange those arguments depending upon what our purpose is, past, present, or future, and then we have to develop the ability or the skill of style, because it's style that allows us to connect with an audience. So our styles are driven by our audience. And if we are incapable of altering and adjusting our style according to who we're going to speak to, that limits to a great degree our ability to be persuasive. So invention, arrangement, and style are the three critical aspects in classical discourse theory, the pedagogy of teaching our students to be successful communicators.
We have a question here. Which is more important in an upper school writing class, creative writing or research paper? Should there, can there be a balance? Now, I'm going to assume from the question that creative writing here doesn't mean novels and things like that. I think that's great. But if we're talking within the domain of prose and things like this, I'll just be honest, I am not a big fan of research papers. And the reason is, and I think there's a real push to have research papers in high school because that's what they do when they get to college. We can't let that dictate what we do. A student who has been well-equipped in rhetoric can write a research paper because they can do rhetorical analysis and figure out what they need to do. I say focus on developing rhetorical skill. Research can get drastically in the way, especially citation. Again, if you have a student who you've equipped in rhetoric, citation is a hand them the handbook, they can do it. It's that simple. Starting to teach it young, they can't do it. Why? Because it's weird, it's complicated, there's parentheses and periods and who knows what else, right? But if you've got a well-equipped rhetoric student, they go, okay, well, I have this type of source, here's the citation, I'm done, right? And I've had that experience with students where in 12th grade when they do their capstone, we spent 5 minutes on citation. Here's Turabian, go. I had one student who had one question, answered the question. Things were golden, right? The other thing is that research tends to be one of two things. Or do you mean research paper informatively, in which case I'll tell you what I did in high school, which is you have to have 5 sources. Why do we need 5 sources when one source gave me all the information I need for my paper? I'm going to go scour books until I find one fact in every other source that I can include so I can have 5 sources on my bibliography. Right? You don't want to have students playing a game. It's not a game. If you mean argumentative, you are talking a high-end rhetorical skill where you're asking them to read different arguments from different positions, often using the same evidence, and to evaluate the way that they're using that evidence. That is a valuable skill. It is an invaluable skill. And it is a high-end rhetorical skill. They are not ready for it until two things. One, educationally, until they've had really some good training in rhetoric and high-end rhetoric. And two, simply in terms of childhood development, they're just not ready for it. It's weird. It's complicated. It's complicated for adults. And so if you're going to do it well, you've got to invest an incredible amount of time. And for me, if I'm going to have time, and everybody knows class time is limited, I'm going to err on, let's get them the skill with and the facility with language. That other stuff we can teach them later, because that's really... Once they can do the synthesis, I can teach them how to write the synthesis. So I want to teach the thinking concept there. I don't want to bog them down in writing in that. Now, I know that's not how everybody does it, but that's how I would answer the question.
Annie, do you have a question?
Outside my scope. Actually, we're out of time.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for...